Hey, it's Conrad Thompson, and you're listening to My World. And of course, we couldn't do it without the Hall of Famer, your friend and mine, the greatest professional wrestler of all time. Ladies and gentlemen, Double J, Jeff Jarrett. Jeff, how are you, man?
Oh, Conrad Thompson. What an episode we have today. We got lots to talk about. Lots of chatter. Shout out Dave Green early in the episode. Boy, oh boy, Conrad. I'm sitting on like fifth gear today. I am ready to rock, coming off a weekend that's just right up my alley, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But no, looking forward to the topic. It's kind of been a long awaited. It my childhood hero in so many ways. Yes, the topic of today is the King Jerry Lawler, a friend, a mentor, my father's business partner for years and years and years, my father's rival for years and years and years. People know him as the King Jerry Lawler with great one-liners for years and years, with the one and only JR, and I think that's where his probably most famous role would be on a global basis. But we're going to go back to his roots and his origins, and so a few stories behind the story, and it's going to be a cool episode of My World. But we got a lot to talk about before we get there, and it's not shoes baseball and the promotional schedule that we've released. We're not going to be talking any WrestleQuest or any gaming or Global Force Entertainment. The website's taking off. I've got my shirt on for Manscaped. We save balls. But, man, we're going to be talking a lot of wrestling today, Conrad, and I can't wait. So I'll throw you back the reins, and I'll just follow your lead wherever you want to go, because you always steer the ship right. But I'm ready, pal. I am absolutely ready for this episode. Oh, boy. The look on your face.
You're not going to talk about Tony Khan doing an angle on TV?
Oh, pal.
I mean, it is the buzz of the wrestling world. Everybody wants to know, what'd you think about Tony Khan getting involved physically? He said he'd never be a television character. And can you believe that now he's doing it? As a reminder, Vince McMahon won the Royal Rumble. He was the ECW champion. He was the WWE champion. And he was doing his very best Eric Bischoff impression. Eric was the original OG authority, going flying through the air at a pay-per-view with Kevin Nash, and became the leader of the NWO. I, for one, am for it. And all the AEW critics and naysayers who say, oh, it's all matches and there's no stories. When we finally get a story, you don't like that either? You can't have it both ways. Let the shit play out. That's the end of my rant. What say you, Jeff?
Your rant, you know what? We just got to start off very combative. What the hell are you talking about? Bischoff being the OG authority figure getting his ass whooped. Have you ever heard of Eddie Marlin?
Nope. Who'd he ever beat?
Oh, well, Grandpa Eddie would kick your ass right now. He would open up his pouch of Red Man, put the biggest damn chew in his mouth, and take his half-drank bottle of Mountain Dew, Diet Mountain Dew, after he's had about seven of them. He'd have that spit bottle, and then he'd beat your ass with a big-ass forearm over and over and over and over, and then he'd go out there and some dastardly heel, most of the time led by Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, or whoever it may be, but authority figures in wrestling since the beginning of time have always toted an ass whooping.
That's, oh, yes.
All about. And Conrad, I only have one regret so far in the story, and we're a long way, I hope so, from finishing the story. Connie, I just got to ask you this.
Okay.
I regret this, but I want to ask you this. Would you love to see the Last Outlaw wrap a guitar around Tony Khan's head?
Oh, please, God. Dear, sweet, sweet, sweet 8-pound baby Jesus in your gold leaf diaper, could you please, please, please allow the Last Outlaw to give perhaps the man with the most heat in the history of wrestling, who never even worked a match, if you could just let him crown Tony Khan and anoint him with a new guitar necklace, all of our IWC dreams could come true. I mean, think about that, dude.
Oh boy.
I mean, you have heat. A guy had the most original cut down for you yesterday, made me laugh out loud driving home.
Oh no.
I sent it to you and I didn't get a response. And I was like, boy, he did not like that
one. Oh no, no. I had a crazy day yesterday.
So you missed it. But there was a pointed description of you that made me belly laugh with,
oh boy,
he's got heat. I love that.
It's from Tony
somehow has more heat. And the idea that y'all are together, like the people who love AEW and Tony Khan would hate you so bad for hitting him with a guitar. But the people who hate Tony Khan and AEW would love you so much for hitting him with a guitar. It checks all the boxes. And if you're thinking what I'm thinking you go finish what the Meltzer driver or the Tony Khan driver started. You wrap him up with a new necklace and that neck brace is going to be a full body cast.
Buddy. Are you actually describe it? And you know, Conrad, your entire professional life, you've put deals together. That's a fair point, right?
Okay, I'll go with that.
You literally, and super successful for those that know, really know. I mean, toys speak for themselves. I'll just kind of leave that right there. But with all being said, the definition of a good deal in the professional wrestling industry is a win-win. Win. There's three components. You got to have the protagonist side and the antagonist side, or the heel and the baby face. You got to have talent and you got to mix it all together. But the biggest winner of all has to be the fans. And you just described, for those who hate Tony, it's a win. For those who love Tony, it's a big ass win for the Last Outlaw. Book it, Connie. What a way to start the episode. I didn't know you'd be heading down that road.
I didn't know we were going to talk about it either, but I've wanted to see it for a long time. I want to see it so bad now. Hey, if we're going to get Tony Khan involved with some physicality, let's light his ass up with a guitar. I, for one, am going to be watching this weekend or this, as you're listening to this, tomorrow night, because Kenny Omega is back. And you can see Kenny Omega live in person. Tickets are on sale now, AEWTIX.com. Coming to see you tomorrow, Winnipeg. But Tony Khan is not there. So it sounds like you might actually have to do a run-in on next year's draft and whack his ass.
Oh, man. What a chatter, buddy. Obviously went to, we'll get to Triple Mania, but so I got to watch the draft and hear about the draft Thursday night, but, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday on my phone, and 700,000 people, or 750, I don't want to get it wrong, in Detroit watched or were a part of or participated in drafting 6-7 rounds of players.
You mean Indianapolis, I think.
No, Detroit.
Okay.
Yeah, Detroit. Detroit was where the draft was. Yeah, I think so. Yes, it was in Detroit. They broke the record. They broke the record that was held by Nashville with 600,000 fans. But what an incredible marketing machine. But who dove right in the middle of that from the war room of the Jacksonville Jaguars? None other than the neck brace man himself. The boss, Tony Khan. What a weekend. Lots of buzz and chatter and all that kind of good stuff. So, I'm actually really looking forward to where Kenny sits on all this. I'll just say that.
Just for those of you keeping score at home, Tennessee had 3 draft picks, 1 fourth rounder, and 2 sixth rounders.
No. Oh, University of Tennessee. Yes.
That little, Cal College you support.
Oh no.
I was just letting everybody know that Alabama had more. As a matter of fact, our Lord and Savior, known as Nick Saban of college football, he has had more first round draft picks than anybody in the entire history of the NFL or college football. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you think about that. And we're talking about 10 players who went to the league this year, Jeff. Your lowly Volunteers had 3. Man, 10 to 3.
Wow. I saw a clip on old Tricky Nicky.
Oh, yeah?
You know what? But it was fascinating. And he talked about draft and players and all this. And he talked about, you know, at the end of the day, you can teach guys how to block at the next level. Mechanics is kind of where he's going with all this. He said, but there's one thing that you just don't know, is that you cannot teach how to guy, you know, to hit a 95 mile an hour fastball or jump a pass to get a receiver. It's the intangible of the it factor of the highest level elite players. And he said, that's what kind of the draft is all about, is that you're digging down and doing your best observations, but at the end of the day, it's still a gamble. Who can really translate to the next level? And you don't really, you can take good guesses and educated guesses and doing a lot of homework and character, performance and really analyze all that. But at the end of the day, are they going to make a difference in the league? He said it's the intangible, and he said it's very, very hard to define. He's good, man. Saban on commentary. Did you get to see any of that?
I got to see very little of it. It was a big weekend here at the Conradison. We moved, so this is maybe the last time you'll see this background here on the show. Maybe not.
Oh, wow.
But I left this room kind of mostly intact, as at least as far as my equipment goes and stuff. But everything else is out of here, Jeff. So it was kind of a crazy weekend over here, but I made sure to sit down in front of my boob tube and fire up Triller TV. Shout out to our mutual friend, Mr. Mike Weber, and watch Triple Mania 32. I was actually at Triple Mania a couple of years ago in October in Mexico City. One of the best wrestling experiences of my life. I enjoyed seeing Alberto Del Rio in his return. I love seeing the former Dolph Ziggler, the real life Nick Nemeth, become the AAA mega champion. It was a really fun show, but without question, my favorite part of the entire show is Double J. You're out there, as a friend of ours might say, looking as only you can look. Look at that jacket. You look like a former president of the NWA. What was that goof's name?
Stanley Black. No, the
NWA or something like that.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha.
Well, he used to wear those gimmick jackets, and now here you are doing your best and coming out to Born in the USA with Satnam fucking Singh carrying an Indian flag. Crack me up. I loved it. Shout out to Larry Dallas and Joe Dabrowski who plugged our podcast a few times, but we got to see QT Marshall, who by the way is a real heat magnet down there, along with Parker Boudreaux, who I just want to plug. I know a lot of people have decided that they want to give up on this guy. If you watch that pay-per-view, you saw his 21st match. He hasn't wrestled in more than a year. His last match was March 3rd of 2023. He was wrestling like once a month for AEW or something like that, after he only had like, I don't know, 6 matches in NXT. But this is a kid who's going to be a big deal one day. I believe in that. He's only 26 years old. He looks like an absolute monster, but he's only had 21 matches. So give him time, show a little patience. But maybe the real star of the match, besides yourself, and we're going to talk about that, was Sam Adonis. And I want to put him on everybody's radar. If you're not familiar with that name, go out of your way to see his work down there. The real life brother of Corey Graves. But man, he understands the business. He's in his early 30s. He's been wrestling since he was a teenager. So he's got like 20 years worth of experience or something crazy. I mean, it's really surprising to me that Sam has not gotten a shot with a major U.S. wrestling organization, but I guess he's carved himself out quite a successful niche in Mexico. He's a huge star down there.
Buddy, and we've talked for months, you know, and a little tidbit of information. I didn't know this. Corey and Sam's father was an independent promoter in Pittsburgh. But man, when you talk about and as we say here on the podcast, the story behind the story. The story behind the story is that if you watch that spectacle this past Saturday, but Sam was the glue is what I like to call it. He's bilingual, but man, he is super good. And when you really understand Sam's, man, his journey, his pedigree, the things that he's done as far as talking about a guy who – I can't even put it in words. I don't want to say just paying his dues. He did 2 to 3 years in the United Kingdom working for Brian Dixon and learning that style and 150, 160 matches a year. And then when you go to Mexico and he started in CMLL and went through, I'll call it the dojo or their training. But when you go into authentic, not kind of, I'm going to watch this on TV and try to wrestle like a luchador. I'm talking about, people, the legendary stories, maybe the Heart Dungeon or going to a dojo in Japan. But when you really train lucha style, and I don't even want to call it the old school way, but I mean, really dig down into it. Sam has all of these skill sets. So he's, 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", American, can go. And again, bilingual, can, I call it, this is probably appropriate on today's podcast, but a true ring general, and, you know, the old school terminology has kind of been lost, but a ring general is somebody who can do their job and everybody else's in the matches, at least help them do their job. And that's Sam. I can't say enough good things about him. He was super, you know, definitely one of the super all-stars of it. And again, yes, he's carved out a niche down there. And here in the United States, independent promoters, I think, and, you know, I don't think Sam really works at marketing himself and all that, but me and Conrad will do that. I mean, he is a true, he knows how to wrestle professionally in a very, and I know this is kind of a jaded word at times, I say sports entertainment, but you have to bring the sport component, but also got to entertain it. And Sam, he can do it all. And Saturday night, it felt really good. All the pieces of the puzzle and that image that you just showed there, Marcus, Satnam Singh for the first time wrestled without a shirt. Conrad.
That he looks monster.
I mean, he is a freaking monster. Look at him. And that gift that's going around on social media where Octagon Jr. And Laredo Kid dived at him. What a presence. What kind of, in a lot of ways, maybe a breakout appearance. I don't want to call it performance because, again, Satnam hadn't had that many matches either. But Parker and Satnam and QT, a pro's pro. But, man, Connie, it got wild in Monterey Saturday night.
I absolutely love the show. I want everybody to go out of their way to see it. I do want to talk a little bit more about what happened that night. But before we do, I want to reference your thing about Satnam. I was watching that show, and of course, you're standing next to him and saying, hey, cameraman, get that camera over here, start at his feet, doing the Andre shot, go the whole body. But when he came back, your positioning next to him is a spectacle that people should go out of their way to see. Because I know if you're watching this or you're listening at home and you think to yourself, self, hey, I'm sure Jeff Jarrett's a good sized guy, but he's not that big as a pro wrestler. I mean, look at all these other big guys. But seeing you in person, you get a scope for, compared to a normal human being, you're a large human. You're a big old Jack fellow. And you're standing next to something that can't be described.
Yes.
And when you're sort of referencing, and I could just see like you pointing up, I mean, he knows when it's going to rain weeks before we do. This is, this is a monster of a human being. And that spectacle just got all over me. And I was like, I even hit pause and I said, guys, do y'all see the comparison here? It was almost like that famous clip of Mean Gene standing next to Andre. And I think they had Andre standing on a box to make it even more crazy, but that's what the spectacle looked like for me in the moment. But that's not even the coolest thing about it. The coolest thing about it to me was for the very first time. Now I've heard about it, but I've never seen it. You're coming down to a chorus of boos and boy, they hate your ass in Mexico. And I'm like, all right, born in the USA. That's not really a patriotic song, but it's getting heat because they're booing. They're all waving American flags except for Satnam, who's got an Indian one. And then I looked in your hand and I said, is that what I think it is? And then there they go as you throw tortillas to the crowd. But then you threw one at Dorian's mom, Mrs. Pena.
Garcella.
This is the equivalent of someone throwing something in Linda McMahon's face. It's a big deal in wrestling in Triplia, or I've said that wrong, but you know what I'm saying. Yep. And then here she comes. Buddy, you got your ass whipped. She ran you out of town. She, again, China 2.0, it happened. You got caught slipping. Now, granted.
Let's just stop right there.
Well, that's what happened.
Bobby Apache is, if there is a female wrestler that represents the brand of AAA, it's her.
Okay.
So I think she was highly offended. For me, just trying to serve some concessions to Mama Pena. I am an American who has stated many, many times before, American wrestling is better than Lucha Libre wrestling. American football or soccer is better than Mexican soccer. American baseball is much better than Mexican baseball, American food is much better than Mexican food. We're better in every category, but I do have some compassion. And when I go to the ring each and every time, all I'm doing is trying to throw. Now, look, I could throw candy out. Like if I went to the ring in the States and threw candy out, Connie, that would probably, oh man, Jeff's the candy man. He's throwing kids at the people. Isn't that nice? Well, that's what I'm doing in Mexico. I am trying to help the lowly Mexicans because it's all the same, whether it's Monterey, Mexico City, Tampico, Chiapas, it doesn't really matter. Just trying to do that. And Mama Pena took high offense to that. She threw some kind of nasty spit water all over me. But then Fabi Apache, and I'll just leave this right here, Connie. Fabi Apache has a royal ass whooping coming. I promise you that. It won't be from a king, but she's got one coming. I can assure you that.
Well, our topic today is the king, Jerry Lawler. I can't wait for us to talk about it. But before we do,
can I say one thing real quick?
Yes, please.
Okay. Back on Sotnum. The thought as you were telling it just popped. Conrad, so when we got to get on the old Delta jet to fly home yesterday morning, or whenever that was, Sunday morning. So we board, Conrad, and when you go to sit down for first class, guess who? I can't leave the name, but I sitting on the window that was going to be sitting right beside Sotnum was a defensive tackle in the NFL. I just leave it at that. A defensive tackle in the NFL.
That's a big row right there.
But hey, if you could have seen the look on his face when it's like he did start because he was down on his phone and he did start because I pictured it all and got the whole.
Oh, at the feet, you saw him do it.
Yes, like, oh no, please tell me, because we all do that, you know, wherever you're sitting on a plane, who's going to sit beside me? And when he realized in Sotnum's deep voice, that's my seat. Conrad, that's when the size difference just blew me away. This guy plays in the NFL and he's a defensive tackle. And my man Sotnum dwarfed him. He's a one in a billion kind of athlete. I was so proud of him. From a very personal level, I could not be more proud of a human being. He stepped up in a unique to say it was a hostile environment. And I kind of prepped him on all that. But he did phenomenal. And there are incredible successful days in front and side of the thing. I'll just say that. All right, Connie, on the topic.
All right, listen, you said I prepped him on that. Well, I can't imagine a scenario where A, Sotnum ever worried about anyone threatening him with physical violence.
No.
And B, how drunk one of those fans would have had to have been to say, I'm going to go tackle Jack and the Beanstalk here. There ain't no way.
No. But I told him to look out for my ass. What are you talking
about? Yeah. You're going to take care of me. Yes.
I said they will be hostile and I'm on the floor the entire time. I'm not in the match. So I'll keep causing a lot of chaos out there. And I said, get ready. They're going to throw beer. They're going to throw everything they get. They might throw their food back at me, be disrespectful. But no, it was, you talking about diving in the deep end in a lucha style match. Sotnum certainly and Parker did as well. So a lot of fun Saturday.
Well, what else was a lot of fun is over the weekend, I saw a business report, and you know how much I'm a nerd for the wrestling business. I love to see, hey, where are things going? Where are things headed? What's hot? What's not? What's creating money? What's drawing money? And we know that there's one thing that draws every time. The Last Outlaw Double J has the hottest selling action figure over at Wrestling Collectibles. Take a look at what we see there. I can't believe this is like taking this long for there to be an AEW Jeff Jarrett figure, but boy, the people who drug their feet in Jacksonville are looking real foolish now. Cause he is the hottest selling action figure in all of Ringside Collectibles. He beat out Cody Rhodes. Who'd he ever beat? He beat out CM Punk. What? He beat out MJF. Remember him? What about Roman Reigns? He's all the way down at 8. Now, my country math says that Jeff Jarrett is 7 times the performer and the draw that Roman Reigns is. The math is right. The evidence is right there. And then at the bottom of the list, hey, nostalgia still sells. Scott Hall and Kevin Nash. That's pretty cool. I'll give that. That's cool. But dude, you outsold Cody Rhodes. You outsold CM Punk. You outsold MJF. You outsold Roman Reigns. And not by a little bit, by a lot bit, the hottest action figure. Folks just can't get enough. And by the way, it's got our podcast logo on it. How cool was this, man? Your first AEW figure.
How about that? Pretty exciting. Yes. I was the attention to detail. Yes. The logo being on there, Connie. My office is a wreck right now, but I remember I was sitting in my chair right at there and you were like, hey man, as we get into this podcast and that kind of, you know, the Jays had been around a while, but he's like, and there's a photo that's in my wall of me, silhouetted that, yep. That guitar up, and you probably can tell the story better than I am, but that logo in there, Connie, it's on Ringside Collectibles. How about that? Congrats to you, my man.
Congrats to Chris McDonald, who made the original logo. But we were thinking, hey man, what if we did like the NBA sort of logo, but with you and a guitar? And there it is. And now it's on an action figure and it's the hottest selling figure around. Go right now to Ringside Collectibles. Be sure to keep this trend going, because I'll tell you this, if he's not the number one seller next week, I'll know that somebody made a call and bought some figures to bump their numbers up.
Here we go.
It's shameful, the game that gets played in wrestling. Sometimes people are going to start putting some respect on your name one way or another. So listen, man, we have wanted to talk about Jerry Lawler on this program for a while, and we've told a little bit of your backstory and your history of your fandom and how high regard you held Randy Savage. I mean, he first really rose to prominence in Memphis and then was on the rocket ship with Vince, and you're still maybe in your peak fandom years when you're seeing all that happen, and you got to think, man, this is what's possible. But then you also had, and I don't think this can really be debated, the greatest territory wrestler of all time in Jerry Lawler. I mean, in terms of not like he went to all the territories, and sure, Lawler did some of that. But I mean, he set up roots, and this was his home, and he did it at a high level. And I'm not just talking about like he was in the main event and he booked himself in the main event. And I know some smart ass naysayer is going to say that. I mean, he drew money. I'm talking about the business of professional wrestling. He lived like a king and was in his bed most every night. If that is not the prototype of a badass wrestling career, I don't know what is, right, Jeff?
I don't even know where to dive off into starting about, but I think at the very highest level, and look, circumstances on so many things, but And I know that there have been different guys say different things, but as far as a professional wrestler, in my opinion, there's nothing Jerry can't do or did, and he'll babyface. And I'm not just talking about that draw money, all kinds of matches, all kinds of stories, all that. And he's an anomaly because there's so many things that go in. Jerry's a complicated person. He's so unique. He's flawed like all of us, but at the very end of the day, I've often thought, now what really sets Jerry apart? Cause never drank, never smoked. Yeah. That's kind of sets you apart especially in the territory days. Another thing, never went into a gym. Never exercised a day in his life. Nope. All this. Okay. Yeah. So there's different things, but at the end of the day, I think if there's one trait, and I'd love to hear your kind of feedback on this and maybe a name game or right off the top to comparative speaking. Cause when you think about the Von Erichs or Dusty or different territory stars, you know, Pat Patterson, we could go on and on and on, but what set Jerry apart from everybody else? And I think at the very core of it is Jerry is truly an artist. His creativity kept him, in my opinion, 72, 73 at the very top of the business. So in the territories, he stayed on top. when a guy his age, most of the time looked at retirement, he transitioned and he was a not a good color commentator. And I know it's debatable, but he was on top as a color commentator for years and years and years. And so there's in the professional wrestling industry, there's nothing really he couldn't do. He booked, he wrestled, a business guy, promo guy, on and on and on, color commentator, all that kind of stuff. His success is unparalleled in the territory days. And I always did try to analyze it, but his creativity, God's gift to him of having that creative mind, set him apart.
I can't wait for us to talk about Lawler. I mean, I don't think it can be debated. He's the biggest star in the history of the Memphis territory. And he was born November 29th, 1949. He has aspirations of being an artist, and we know how fabulous he is with a pen and paper and a disc jockey. And I believe he was actually in Hendersonville, Tennessee when he became a wrestler. Is that the story you've heard?
No. He started in Memphis, got trained by some folks, started over in Arkansas. In those days, it wasn't called independent wrestling. It was called outlaw little shows because he couldn't get on the territory circuit, but nobody could when they broke in. So there were little small shows, but man, it didn't take him long. And the real entry into the business is Jackie Fargo. At the time, he wasn't called the King of Memphis, but he was by far the number one box office attraction, and it set up roots in Memphis. He had a restaurant nightclub in Memphis, and Lawler, with his charm, he sent in drawings, paintings or whatever it may be to the studio, but so the connection was there at a very early age, WHBQ, that's the ABC affiliate where wrestling was on, but him and Jackie Fargo became friends. And that was really his, I guess you could say, his entrance into the territory was that relationship between him and Jackie, the top babyface draw.
I think the credit I've heard once upon a time is Aubrey Griffith being the first wrestling promoter mm-hmm. to bring Jerry in. Does that name ring a bell to you, Aubrey Griffith?
I believe it's over. Yeah. But, and look, this is obviously 71. I was 4 years old. So I'm getting this second or hearing it second through the years. He started on small independents in Eastern Arkansas, just right across the bridge. Memphis is right there on the line. So Mississippi, Arkansas and Tennessee all come together right there in that corner of the state. But he started over in independence in independent shots in Arkansas.
We got to talk about how Lawler was almost an immediate star. He's going to be the tri-state champion by September of 71, within 2 years of debuting. Of course, by the end of his career, which I think we're there now, he's held over 200 titles in his career. What do you think it was about Jerry that endeared him to the fans in this territory so quickly, so easily?
You know, Conrad, when just looking at that picture right there, Jerry looked like a man, if you will, at 22 years of age, you know, hair on his chest. He had broad shoulders. He didn't have that young, quote unquote, baby face look that some guys do. So when he entered into the business and the true confidence that came out of him, and this is, again, you can go back and watch some of his early promos when he got with Sam Bass, but he had been in the business a couple of years of that. But, from my father and look, I'd ask a lot of folks. I was, to this day, I'm still a huge fan of Jerry's career. It's unbelievable. But at the early age, the King was the man. And when I'm 10, 11 years old, or not even that old, King was selling out and making money, and my father's promoter, and obviously he's making money, and just the success that he brought. But in those early days, Jerry, again, going back to his artistic and creative mind, he came out of the womb being able to cut a promo. And so from his very earliest days in the business, he could talk. And that is something that, as time has gone on through the years, it's kind of amazing how that's kind of been left by the wayside from time to time, but how important it is. But, you know, in today's modern era, you look at a MJF or a Sami Zayn, or, okay, if you want a guy who's through the generations, Paul Heyman can talk his ass off. In these early 70s, if you could, quote unquote, just wrestle, then you had a, for all intents and purposes, a journeyman career. What sets you apart from a mid-card to a main eventer in those days is, can you sell money? Can you sell tickets with your mouth? And Jerry could from day one.
We should also mention that the Observer had this to say. He, Jerry Lawler, became a single star when Booker Jerry Jarrett chose him to be the top heel to feud with veteran headliner Jackie Fargo. In reality, Lawler and Fargo were best friends and remained so, even though Lawler eventually took Fargo's spot as the area's biggest star. What do you think your dad liked so much about Jerry Lawler?
I have heard this come out of my father's mouth so many different times in referencing when he would talk to me, talk to Billy Travis, talk to others, other talent. I mean, just on and on. Even when Dad got out, he would say something to the effect of, you know, back when me and Lawler, you know, I used to tell Lawler, you know, Lawler used to do just, it's almost like a on the compass of Jerry Jarrett, you know, career, Lawler was in a lot of ways just such a big part of it. But my dad told me that, again, Fargo, I can't tell you exactly what the age he was in the early 70s, but Fargo had traveled, you know, he had worked in New York, he'd worked the territories and all that. And so Jackie was not a guy that my dad looked at and said, I'm going to build a company around. Jackie had,
he was born in 30. So if we're talking early 70s, he's early 40s.
Okay. So thank you. That gives the point that he looked at Jackie, and Jackie was, I can't say on his last leg, because Jackie drew money into his 60s, easily into his 60s. So he knew that I needed to develop someone. Well, they had a natural relationship. But again, the business metrics dictated everything. My dad might have loved Jerry Lawler and loved Jackie Fargo. And at this time in 72, 73, Nick Gulas and Roy Welch were the owners of the business. But friends are friends, but business is business. If they didn't sell tickets and put butts in seats, it was all out the window. But when he got Lawler and a part of the territory, and he was booking for Roy and seeing the numbers, and Jackie could tell a story with his promos like none other and really entertain him and everything that went with that. But Lawler could talk his ass off. And again, talking about a ring general, he made Jackie, and at Jackie's 40s, Lawler worked around him if need be. Jackie could still go to a certain degree. But again, Lawler knew how to make his opponent get over, and he stayed over, and it just, the success just kept growing and kept growing and kept growing. But it goes back to Lawler knew how to talk to people in the building, entertain them, get his ass kicked. And then all of a sudden Lawler gets his hand raised. Oh man, I want to come back next week. Cause next week, if you convince me and give me the right mindset and draw the right picture, damn it, Lawler, this is the week that he's getting his ass whipped. This is the week he's getting his head shaved. This is the week he's losing his title. It was simple, but very, very, very disciplined. You better sell tickets.
I know that some of our listeners are really just familiar with your work in the WWF, WCW, TNA, and AEW. But if we go way back, man, Jackie Fargo, a real influential performer in the wrestling business, to the point where I think a lot of people, when they would see you in the WWF or WCW, I've heard people say this, oh, he's stealing Ric Flair's strut. Yeah. It was actually a Jackie Fargo strut, was it not?
Absolutely. And again, you touched on Savage, and you know, this is the fun part for me when I really sit here and talk about it and analyze it and hear myself talk. Savage is in the top three. Lawler is the second of the top three. But I think if I have to go back to kind of that OG talent that I just was kind of mesmerized, that I used to think, I subconsciously thought, why is this so damn good? And then I learned later, Jackie Fargo had the ability to make you passionately care for him. But before he started selling, he entertained your ass off. The struts, he would kick the heels in the ass and make fun of them. And, you know, just all nowadays they'd be called maybe ha-ha or comedy spots. But in the context of these things, it's like Muhammad Ali warming up for a fight. Fargo would kind of play with his opponent and kind of play the mind games and entertain folks. And you all, in my mind as a little kid, I thought, damn, Fargo is, he's just having fun up there and entertaining us and psyching his opponent out and toying with him. Once he gets going, he's going to kick the shit out of this guy. But man, he's going to entertain us and have fun with him first. And then all of a sudden the heel cheats and Jackie's down selling, and Jackie knew how to sell, and you couldn't wait for him to make the comeback. Jackie, Jerry, and Randy all have brought something different to the table. So it, yes, those three influenced me the most in my career. And still to this day, they do.
I want to ask you real quick about Fargo, because I know that you've shared advice that he gave you early in your career about the key to longevity in the business. Can you share that with us again?
You know, Jackie, again, he literally sold tickets. You know, my dad brought him back and he knighted Stan Lane and Steve Kern as the Fabulous Ones. But what Jackie always taught me was, is that a few things, and look, Jackie smoked cigars, drank beer, different era. But when he came to the building, and even in his later years, I mean, I got to do a 6-man tag, a couple of this is, and he would say, man, hey man, you stand in the gym, you're doing this, you're doing that. But he always said, Jeff, figure out the story that needs to be told and do your promo and draw out a picture in the people's mind on what's going to happen or what you hope to happen, or maybe throw in there, he wouldn't use these words, but I'm using it, kind of throw in there a little fear, what could happen, how you might be put in jeopardy. But he would, you know, in modern day time, Mick Foley does this, John Cena did this, other guys, Lawler perfected it, all this. But Fargo just kind of had some pillars that create that promo and tell that story. And if you can do that, you're going to have a long career. Also, when you get in the ring, respect your opponent and let the audience know that. But Jeff, when you're down selling, the people got to believe, when as a babyface, and then on the flip side, if you're a heel, the people got to believe that you're going to get up and kick the shit out of them. And he's like, Jeff, the business has changed and evolved, and now this is the mid-80s. And look, on the other channels were Hulk Hogan and Demolition and Axe and Warlord and, you know, Brett and Mark, you know, just the bodies became much more a part of it. And then, you know, he was leaned into heavy. Jeff, tell your story, look the part, and always have the ability. And again, different era, different time, but always have the ability to come back next week and right the wrong.
And you started that career, I can't believe this is real, 38 years and 23 days ago.
That's crazy, Conrad.
Hey, let's talk about Jerry Lawler a little more. You know, we know him these days as the king, but when he first gets going, he was not the king. As I understand it, that story came around a little later, thanks to a fellow named Bobby Shane. What can you tell us about that story and how Lawler became the king?
Yeah, Bobby Shane went off to Australia, and he was the king of wrestling. And look, there's been, I think, I'm certainly people are going to say, oh, there was a king in Texas, or there's a king in San Francisco. But Bobby Shane, working in the Atlanta territory, and my dad would go down and book and had a relationship and through the years. But, you know, the story goes that, and Lawler had done some shots down there, but when he left, they had a conversation, and, you know, you got to remember, this is 72, 73, 74. There was another king in town, and I'm talking about Memphis, and that'd be Elvis Aaron Presley, the king of rock and roll. So Memphis has had some royalty down there. So the king of wrestling became Jerry Lawler. And man, oh, man, did that moniker stick. And did he truly, I guess you could say, fulfill it? Because, I mean, it was amazing how through the years, how he wrapped that into promos. And I might get people to this day. You know, he morphed into it, but yeah, the King Jerry Lawler, I guess you could say knighted from, King Bobby Shane.
And then one day he just shows up rocking a damn crown, right? I mean, just out of nowhere, he was the King.
I love it. And very, very similar to, keep that bad boy off, man. That is beautiful throughout the episode.
There's it is our Jerry Lawler episode. So
let me ask you. Is that from the King?
The King has a guy in Tennessee who makes them. I don't know if I should say his name on the air, but you know who I'm talking about. He made this one for me.
Yeah, so that is a King. That's what I was saying. Lawler, you know,
we have different head sizes. I could not wear his, as you might imagine.
Point being, that is a true, authentic.
It's the real deal. Yeah, that's like his style. Now, it's not ring used. You know, that's what I normally collect. But I wanted to be an asshole and wear one around the house.
You can't have a ring. Use one and wear that with you and Megan doing the wild thing. You got to have one that stays on.
Can you imagine, you know that nothing happened in Pondwater Dave, right?
That good for nothing hit from Mississippi who's transplanted it down over in Texas. Yeah, I know.
The worst.
I speak fondly of Pondwater.
Do you know that he had relations with his wife wearing wrestling gimmicks?
Shut the front door.
Now, I thought that happened on the road with the boys back in the day, you know, with super fan ladies. I get it. They wanted to. Yeah. Okay. But so I was like, all right, well, I guess, you know. And then as he kept telling the story, I realized the gimmick he was wearing was one of my flare robes. It was my property he was using to do this in my own house. After I went to bed, he came down in the studio, grabbed a robe, took care of some business. That robe is no longer here. I've sold it. And of course he's like, well, you know, Flair did. And I was like, I don't want to think. What are we doing?
Conrad, can I ask you a serious question?
Yeah.
Do you think he blew up when he had,
I love you for that. Every now and again, we'll do some inside stuff that's just for me and you. And there was one. Listen, I loved the King evolution. I mean, it is interesting to think. You know, I've been talking about this a lot lately with some of my friends. What if this one thing changed? The big whole what if scenario, like, what if, you know, Sean would have been at WrestleMania 13? Who would Austin have worked? It wouldn't have been a double turn. You know what I mean? Like, what if Triple H wouldn't have been in the doghouse from the curtain call and Austin didn't win King of the Ring and he doesn't wind up working Jake and he doesn't say Austin 316?
Yep.
So, in that same line of thinking, it's hard to even imagine what Lawler's career would have looked like without the King, right? Like without the crown.
So doing the research and looking at, shout out D, good job, because, and we've, you know, I've read the research on this a couple of times, but it occurred to me on the elliptical this morning, Conrad, when you take everything in, what's the word, serendipity? I don't know if that's the right word.
Yeah.
Just there are unique set of circumstances that I don't believe in coincidences, only convergences. But when you think about the timing of everything and that fate or whatever it may be between Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler, the timings of their career, the timing of Fargo really not wanting to do full time, but he was by far the biggest box office attraction. Had Lawler come out along 7-8 years before, Fargo wasn't going to be ready to give up a seat. If Lawler had come around 7-8 years later, Fargo had been done, retired. The timing of him having the top baby face, literally wanting to knight a good buddy of him, my dad, you know, burning and going, and Roy Welch keeping him kayfabe Booker, and then it came out that he was the Booker, and my dad wasn't the guy who really wanted to wrestle day in and day out. He loved booking. He loved the business component of it. So here's, we'll call it, you know, my dad, the producer, if you will, and how they hit it off creative and the yin and the yang of their personalities. just there's several things throughout Lawler's career that you can't put your thumb on, him being called the king. And look, if Bobby Shane hadn't said, "Hey man, I'm going to go take this Australia gig. It's red hot and I'm going over there." That might not have happened. The Fargo thing, my dad booking. And we're going to get into a couple of other situations throughout Lawler's career that are, you would, when you put it all together, you just go, "Hey man, what a charmed, beautifully timed career." It's really, really cool to take a step back and look at a snapshot. And that's where, when I start thinking about all of that, how Lawler treated me. He at times he treated me like a buddy. At times he was very stern with me and let me know. He also had some compassion from time to time because he knew how hard my father was on me. He also had a passion for this business and the things he taught me. You know, that photo right there taken by Jim Cornette back at Louisville Gardens, probably 81, 82. And you know, the night we took that, who would have ever thought all these years later, I'm sitting down doing a podcast, but there are some unique set of circumstances. Lawler, we're going to get into a Handsome Jimmy Valiant deal, a Bill Dundee deal. I mean, Lord, my father and Lawler, they're 60, 77, 76, 77, 78, their time in the ring together. And where my dad had moved into the top babyface in the territory, and but him being more willing to, "I'm going to keep Lawler hot, not worry about my in-ring career," just all the things that happened. But man, oh man, he drew nothing but money in Memphis.
I got to give some credit to Dave Meltzer, because he did some research here for us, because this all predates my fandom. But Dave would say that his most successful, talking about Lawler, his most successful time period started when he was in his mid-20s. He's 24 when he starts to rise to stardom, with becoming a big drawing card in the area as the Southern Junior Heavyweight Champion. His opponent in this feud is Ricky Gibson. So that's the brother of Robert, the father of Eddie.
No. Ricky and Robert Gibson. That you're getting Gilbert's. This is Gibson.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about the feud here in the hair match, because that was like his specialty and what he first starts drawing against Ricky with, right?
So yeah, and again, God, and these kind of podcasts and discussions, and you think through it, and things haven't really changed, although surely they've had, and a Netflix deal and a huge rights increase, and you know, AEW, the frontier headed down, and all, just how the business is. But the very core of it is storytelling. And so the models change. Now it's Wednesday to Wednesday on Dynamite, or Saturday to Saturday on Collision, or what have you. But in these days, it was do TV, get their ass to come out, buy a ticket, and then you go back to TV. The episodic nature of the storytelling. Well, Lawler was a Southern Heavyweight Champion. And Ricky Gibson, again, older brother of Robert. Ricky passed away in a car crash. A hell of a talent. No, he didn't die in the wreck, but hurt, and that ended his
in-ring career. Yeah,
career. But anyway, great talent. But Lawler had built him as basically the top heel, and they would bring guys in. Well, guys that could work like a Ricky Gibson, it was perfect. And then you switch the title and build and all that kind of stuff. But again, I'm going to go back to Lawler's creativity. So every Saturday morning, having the ability to paint the picture so the viewer, who became the consumer, could really drill down and listen and imagine. And he, as a heel, would essentially paint that picture where the people would say, "By God, Ricky Gibson is going to get his ass Monday night, and we're going to see a bald Jerry Lawler." Because, of course, Lawler painting the picture verbally of him being, you know, with his head shaved. And he would talk about that on that. But at the end of the day, and that's where the chain got over, when people would come in, and I know this is in the late 80s, Conrad, young talent that would come in and they would say, "My God, Lawler just goes in his tights and pulls out a chain and everybody in the building stands up." What they didn't realize for 20 years is that that's how Lawler, that was one of his finishes. Yes, the pile driver or the fist off the second rope. But Lawler, as a heel, would get his ass kicked and Ricky Gibson would look great and the people false finish. And, oh, my God, we're going to see a bald Lawler. We're going to see a bald Lawler. We're going to see a bald Lawler. Sam Bass or Lawler pull out of his tights, throw that chain in, he wrap it. Cole cocked the guy. Of course, Lawler could throw, still to this day, the most believable punch and knock a guy out and boom. They would steal the thunder right up from under it. And that is how Lawler built the chain and built the hair match as his specialty. Again, going back to his creativity.
It's pretty remarkable to think how simplistic storytelling could be and how effective it could be. Pro wrestling, when it's done right, you don't have to overcomplicate it. The story in this first big, there's two big sellouts. His first two big sellouts Lawler has are against Ricky Gibson. The first match is where he loses the title to Ricky Gibson as the junior Southern heavyweight champion. And Fargo's the referee. The next time back, in order to get a rematch, Lawler has to put his hair on the line in order to regain a shot at the title. And he does it. But this hair match, you know, that's something that's been around for a long time. I mean, it's still a big deal in Mexico. We saw Sam Adonis that we talked about at the top of the show get a new haircut a few weeks ago. But I'm still fascinated that, hey man, you don't have to overcomplicate it. When it's good and it's effective and it's done right, it works. And Lawler was taking that to another level here week in, week out, was he not?
Yeah, his promo skills. I mean, yes. The Southern heavyweight title. And we're going to get into some world heavyweight title discussions often, but the people in the audience, they were so immersed and felt like they knew Lawler. They hated his ass. Like the people in Mexico, they genuinely hate my pompous American ass and everything I stand for. And Lawler, that was him. He was this arrogant king that could wrestle his ass off, but by God, he cheats every damn time. And it's just simplistic, but fantastic storytelling.
You know, we're obviously pushing to hype this up, that there's nothing more humiliating than having your head shaved. And that's a pattern that you would see in wrestling. I mean, even JCP 10 years after this is going to be talking about you bald headed goof. I mean, so hair matches were not necessarily a new thing, but it worked and it sold out. And now we got to turn the volume up and we would start to see a harder edge with Jerry Lawler. Cause he's that damn dirty heel cheater. So he's going to have the hidden chain. And when he becomes a baby face, that he could still do it, but now the fans are pulling for him to do it. And he's doing these outrageous gimmick matches. And I think sometimes this gets glossed over. For whatever reason, people sort of say, oh, well, that's just that Memphis stuff. But Lawler, yes, Jerry the King Lawler, he was even doing Texas Chainsaw death matches. I mean, not really, but I'm saying like he's willing to put himself out there with those sort of silly over the top gimmicks. And he's not afraid to get a little violent. Would you agree with that?
And there's a stat and the Memphis Mark James or I know Cornette kept great records or there's historians, all this, but I want to say it's 76. I don't think this was in our notes, but out of 52 weeks, Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler were in some type of match for 46 of the 52. And people today go, what the hell is that about? Now they were in singles and tags and six bands and stipulations and just all those different kind of matches. But it again goes into the episodic nature of how people, I don't say people, human nature. It's a story. And Lawler, again, the brilliance of his storytelling, and you just barely touched on the babyface turn. And I don't know if we're going to get into that. I'll jump into that. The fact that Jerry had the timing or the good fortune, he was going to retire and had became babyface and done the chasing and all that. And they lined up that he's going to retire from wrestling and going to get into a singing career. And he goes on stage and sings it. And Handsome Jimmy Valiant cracks him. And so he decides not to retire. that babyface run of Lawler Valiant was a whole nother level of Jerry. And, you know, Jimmy was a box office attraction, Valiant Brothers in New York and all that, but it was a whole nother monster babyface run. And Jerry just had that, whether it was Jackie Fargo, Jerry Jarrett, Bill Dundee, Handsome Jimmy Valiant. But again, it all going to me centers back on to his ability to tell a story and didn't care. The Terry Funk empty arena match. I could go on and on, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, Conrad, but it just, it's to me, his career is fascinating.
Well, there's no doubt. And I don't think we can even fit all of our Jerry Lawler conversation into a single episode. I mean, how could you possibly talk about a career that spanned, you know, from the 60s to now in a couple hours? But in 74, that's when something major happens. It's a big summer program where Lawler is going to challenge Jack Briscoe for the NWA world title. Now, I know these days, respectfully, the NWA is, well, not what it once was. But back then, I just want to remind everybody, the WWE has not always been the juggernaut they are now. In 1974, the richest, most valuable prize in all of wrestling was the 10 pounds of gold that was owned and operated and manipulated by the man you're watching on YouTube right now at myworldpod.com, Mr. Jack Briscoe. And this is the richest prize of them all. This is the equivalent of being the Super Bowl MVP, of winning the World Series trophy, of cutting the net after the NBA finals or the NCAA tournament. I mean, this is the high grass here. And the Observer says this: the idea was Lawler would beat them all, but the reality was it didn't happen that way. Some of the big stars of the era wouldn't do jobs even out of their own territory, so Jarrett had to settle for DQ finishes. But they kept tape footage, and they were among the first, if not the first promotion, to do music videos. Among those brought in were The Sheik, Bobo Brazil, Mr. Wrestling 2, Dick the Bruiser, Robert Fuller, Rufus Jones, and Jerry Briscoe. But we got close, but we never quite got the NWA title. Do you remember as a kid feeling like Lawler challenging for the title was a big deal? Was it a big deal to you? Was it a big deal to the fans of the territory? Like his, because he's been the top guy for a while, and it felt like with all that momentum, hey, they might go with it, and then they didn't. Talk to me about what you remember of that as a fan.
See, and I don't have any, you know, and look, obviously I'm in school as a kid, and Nashville was a different market than Memphis. And when I was a little boy, Nick was running Nashville. And so my dad was not promoting Nashville till kind of the late '70s, I think is the time frame. But anyway, I don't have any fond memories or vivid memories of Lawler specifically in that. But, you know, when my dad started explaining all the stories about all that and the understanding the chase and everything that went with it, I guess the long and the short of it during this era, the belt meant more than, and look, my dad loved the Briscoes and the Funks and Harley and, you know, just the whole iterations of those 70s champions in so many ways, but the belt was the attraction. And so the chase for my dad, and whether it was Lawler and Ricky Gibson or Lawler and plug in a number of names, he would bring in those number one contenders. At one time, it was even Andre, but bringing in all those top names and the winner would get a world title shot. My dad, they booked it to get Lawler to the, I guess you could say the apex, and then something would be stolen out from under him. But yeah, so, you know, there was a time when my dad pushed for Lawler to be the NWA champion. And I think Lawler wanted it, but at the end of the day, it wasn't in the cards. And I don't think either one of them was extremely disappointed, because again, Lawler gets to stay home, make a boatload of money. Did they really want it? Probably more for fame as opposed to fortune. And Jerry Lawler and Jerry Jarrett were about money more than fame.
Let's talk a little bit about the match itself. We mentioned all the opponents that are going to come in the meantime. And I just want to make sure that's not lost, because this is how you build a challenger for the NWA title. He brings in the Sheik, one of the top drawing cards from the Detroit area, and Lawler gets the win. He brings in Bobo Brazil, same thing. He brings in Mr. Wrestling number 2, who'd been all over the place, but certainly Georgia Championship Wrestling on national television. He brings in Dick the Bruiser. He brings in Robert Fuller, Rufus Jones, and Jerry Briscoe. It's all to build to this world title match that happens on September 16th, 1974. And Briscoe's a natural babyface, and Lawler is one of the best heels in the business. But Memphis gets behind Lawler because he's their hometown guy. So even though he's the bad guy, he's our bad guy. And I just find that whole story fascinating. Meltzer would write the story. He says, in those days when Briscoe was champion, he had a very subtle trick, which was late in the match when the opponent, usually a babyface, would hit their finisher. He'd drape his foot on the rope. It seems like nothing, but it spoke to the aura Briscoe had at the time when he thought he was above that kind of thing. Briscoe had already done the same thing in Florida against a heel Dusty Rhodes. The idea was for Rhodes to eventually turn face, and the match that set it off was Rhodes hanging with Briscoe in a wrestling match for the title, dropping the elbow, and Briscoe just getting his foot on the rope. It was enough to get the fans of Florida to cheer Rhodes, who'd been a top heel for a few years. And if it worked with Rhodes, it was going to work even more with Lawler, since Briscoe had emotional ties with Florida fans, but no such ties in Memphis. So, guys, to recap here, Lawler hits his finish. Everyone is under the impression he's about to win the NWA world title. And by simply putting his foot on the rope, meaning I can't kick out, but I can do this, it got Lawler over. He became a babyface. It's just magical to me that we have beat up wrestling and dissected it and discussed it and digested it and regurgitated it. I mean, we've manipulated it every which way that we've got to have these ridiculous debates online. But back in the day, well, how'd you turn heel? Well, I hit my finish and then the guy put his foot on the rope. What? It's remarkable, is it not?
Yes. And that's what I was standing backstage Saturday at Triple Mania, and Conrad, watching on the big screens at the baseball stadium, and the people kept coming in Saturday night. I mean, second match, and you can literally see how they were coming in up at the very top over and over and over and over, and right now AAA Origins, but it is, they're bringing, they're on one aspect, you could say, they're selling nostalgia in so many ways, old factions, talent that was super over years, but that was a big part of the show. And I go back to, it's all that emotional connection. People are coming out over 15,000 strong because they have that emotional connection with these characters. And so, yes, we've referenced Caitlin Clark here recently. I think she's the first female video game basketball player. You're watching, the guy's been doing it for a while. And look, in today's wrestling, the Ospreys of the world, Kenny Omega, they can do things that the 70s generation, the 80s generation, the 90s generation could never dream of. But the very simplistic storytelling, and I'm going to use this as an example, Briscoe putting his foot on the ropes just made, just the feel of it. In today's modern world, the kick out on one.
Yes.
You can put all the moves and everything into it, but the right timing, with the right emotion, with the most simplistic, I'm not going to overthink this. Instead of kicking out on the traditional two, I'm going to do one. Everybody in that arena stood up, and that's how Briscoe and Lawler did. They told that story, and son of a gun, that dastardly Lawler heel, but he's our bad guy. Damn it, he should have won it. Oh, man. I love the business because of this kind of stuff. I love it.
Lawler's going to have some great heel versus heel programs as well. He's going to be working with the Mongolian Stomper. But maybe the most interesting thing that I want to mention here, and we've touched on it before, the same week that Antonio Inoki is wrestling or fighting Muhammad Ali, and I have that poster somewhere here in the house, or I guess it's in storage now, but it was a landmark event. I mean, Inoki is just a god in Japan, and we know the legacy that Muhammad Ali has. So the idea that we had a boxer versus a wrestler, that is decades before anybody even thought about MMA or UFC or mixed martial arts of any sort. But that was a hypothetical conversation that guys would just have all the time. What if this guy fought that guy? Talking like a wrestler versus a boxer, or a Bruce Lee type versus a boxer. That sort of thing happened all the time. So when it actually happened, your dad and Jerry Lawler got together and said, well, let's do a boxer versus a wrestler program with The Rock's dad, Rocky Johnson. So we're going to position this whole Inoki Muhammad Ali thing with our own homegrown talent of Jerry Lawler and Rocky Johnson. That's pretty special. The same week that Inoki Ali is happening. I mean, that right there is having your finger on the pulse.
Folks, if you're driving down the road and just listening to audio, do yourself a favor when this YouTube clip comes out, or maybe even Google and research it. This photo right now of the King of Memphis, he wears the singlet, he pulls the strap down, wears a crown to the ring. But for this encounter, Rocky Johnson looks like he came right out of a heavyweight prize fight and kicked Muhammad Ali's ass. And across the ring is this dastardly heel, Jerry Lawler, in white boxing shorts. It's totally kind of, I don't want to say fish out of water, but it didn't look like the normal got up.
He's wearing Ali-style trunks there.
Yes. And the picture, and you talk about making some money. It was, again, this is, man, and you'll take it the right way. Others won't. If this isn't sports entertainment, I don't know what is.
Oh, of course it is.
What year is this?
That's the year of Inoki. So let me look that up.
Yeah, so 75, 76, I'm trying to think.
Yeah, it was June 26, 1976.
Oh, gosh. I mean, box office. And this, just huge. To this day, I think The Rock remembers, you know, hearing the stories of this finally. But it just worked.
By the way, it drew 11,188 fans. The match went down a few days before the Inoki fight. It was June 21st. 1976. So they found out, obviously the world knew Ali Inoki. And what do you know? 5 days before anybody sees it, they're seeing it in Memphis, Jerry Lawler versus Rocky Johnson. It got mainstream media coverage, but more importantly, I just want to mention again, 11,188 fans. And these are the same fans. I mean, these days when WWE comes to your town, it happens what, once a year, twice a year? Imagine running the same building every freaking week on the same day of the same week, and 11,188 came out. Like, there's no audience fatigue here because you guys were keeping it fresh. And that's the magic of Jerry Lawler. Would you agree?
Yes. Again, he's talking about getting his head shaved 1 week. Then the next week there is this, you know, water cooler talk kind of, spectacle. Rocky Johnson, the people believed he was a legitimate heavyweight boxer. Lawler is going to get his ass whooped because he's got to put on gloves. Let's see how he can really fight when he can't go in his tights and get that chain. Let's see how he can really fight where, when you got to go by boxing rules. And again, excuse me, going back to the picture that Lawler painted about stepping into the ring and letting the people know, subtly, I can't use the chain. I can't cheat. I got to go by these damn rules of boxing. I've got gloves on. I've never really boxed in my entire life. I'm going against a heavyweight prize fighter. If you listen to it closely enough, he makes himself the underdog that you hate. There's no way he should win. But boy, oh boy, that's the brilliance and the creativity of Lawler that just kept building and kept building and kept building the heat.
The biggest rivalry in Lawler's career is going to come the following year. 1977 is when he starts his feud with Bill Dundee, and it's going to run for like 20 years. And there's a lot of our listeners who are familiar with Bill Dundee from his very brief appearances in WCW with Lord Steven Regal and whatnot. And then, of course, some of our listeners remember that his son was a part of PG-13, who were also in WWE at WrestleMania 13 and all that. But Bill Dundee is largely not a national wrestling name, but if you grew up in this territory, in this era, he was one of the biggest stars of them all. Actual physical stature be damned. What was it that made Bill Dundee so special? Just his ability to talk, his showmanship, something else?
You know, Bill, and like you said, I like the picture you painted, but Bill is a, you know, born and raised in Scotland. I think he was 6, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, worked on the circus in his teen years, moved around in the UK, but he learned to wrestle and he went to Australia and got hooked up with a wrestler by the name of George Barnes. And George Barnes and Bill Dundee got booked in the Tennessee territory. And I think George got homesick and Bill's like, hell no, I love it here. And he stayed around here. So when you again look at Lawler and Fargo, that feud, and then it was Lawler and Jerry Jarrett. And so now, you know, and you know, the world title shot and all that kind of stuff. My dad was a baby face that didn't holler, didn't scream. He cried multiple times in promos. He endeared the people. He's the boy next door, good looking baby face kid with fire. But all he did was sell, and either give the hot tag to Tojo or Fargo. And then he had his singles run. But that was all intents purposes. That was kind of the top baby face, if you will, of the territory. Along comes Bill Dundee, who is shorter than Lawler, but his ability to cut a pissed off Aussie, you know, the superstar from down under, you know, from Australia, was where he claimed he went from. But Bill's ability to cut a promo was so damn believable, and he could work. I mean, back in the 70s, he's jumping off and doing the swerve stomp onto Lawler, and him and Lawler had a chemistry. They naturally, their personalities, they'd never sit down at lunch together. If they went to school together, they would have been in different cliques. They just weren't the same type guys. But business is business, and the people knew there was an underlying animosity because Bill Dundee legitimately, you more or less, you know, be an orphan from Scotland and go to Australia and come to America. You talk about wanting to, I mean, truly, truly, truly fight for your life. Bill loved Tennessee and wanted to stay here, but the only way he's going to be able to do that was sell tickets. Now, the audience didn't know that, but my dad knew that, Lawler knew that. So Bill put everything he had into his opportunity when he got the ability to work on top, and he made the most of it. And Lawler respected that. And they had some of the damnedest knockdown dragouts, but their chemistry was unbelievable. They didn't mind, you know, laying it in. But again, they didn't get along at all. I mean, at all. But guess what both of them had? They had this insatiable desire and had this habit called eating. And when you're eating, depends on ticket sales, you drop all the BS. And when I tell you, they used to have classic matches, and they'd put some music to it. And the music videos, there's several out there that come to mind, but Winner Takes It All, ABBA, I don't know. There's several videos, but man, what a classic rivalry that lasted 20 years.
Not only a classic rivalry that lasted 20 years, but one that, boy, they did everything along the way. I mean, we talked earlier about a hair match. They had perhaps the most crazy hair match that I remember hearing about. Tell everybody about this now infamous Lawler Dundee hair match.
Again, now, but this time, you know, as they roll along, Lawler's classic ability to draw that picture, and everybody knew the rivalry. And again, now we're a good 10 years into the king of, you know, and he'd gone through Handsome Jimmy Valiant. You know, there was all kinds of feuds that he had had, but him and Dundee got into it, and people knew that Dundee was married and his wife Beverly, and the circumstances presented itself that actually, as the chips fell, Dundee wanted that Southern Heavyweight Championship and wanted revenge and everything that went with it. He put his wife's hair up. And when when the viewer is sitting at home going, now, wait a minute, I can kind of understand either Lawler's going to lose their hair or maybe a belt. Or, okay, no, so now it's Lawler and Dundee, hair versus hair. Okay, wait a minute. Now, there's a situation where Dundee's wife could possibly lose her hair? No way. Well, again, 52 weeks a year, episodic storytelling. You damn right they showed up because Bev put her hair up, and I wish we had an image of that to show because it's just what a story, what a just that's Memphis Wrestling 101.
It's really unbelievable what we're talking about. I mean, just having a lady get her head shaved like that just feels unfathomable. And I know that we've seen it in wrestling since, but they did it first and it was all about getting people to buy tickets next week. And that's something that you just can't shake off. Like either you are a promoter or you're not. And Bill Dundee is a promoter to this very day. I think our producer Marcus has a photo of Bill Dundee's actual car today. So if he's coming to a town near you, this is what he's pulling up in. Take a look at this.
Is that a Crown Vic, Connie? Is that a Crown Vic?
But look at the back. That's my favorite part. Like I know everybody focuses on him posing with the belt, kneeling down and superstar Bill Dundee and the stars around him. They did a nice job on this wrap, but at the back for bookings and merchandising, he lists his website, bill-superstar-dundee-enterprises.com.
That's your heart, Conrad.
My right. God, I just absolutely love this man and how old school it is. These are the roots of wrestling, and that's what Memphis was like. And listen, I know that some of our listeners, they think it was all about, you know, Rock and Austin and Hogan and Savage or what have you. And I get that. But if you grew up in this area, boy, it was Lawler and Dundee. I mean, it just was. And it's such an incredible draw, and it works so well that they're going to do that retirement story that leads to that Jimmy Valiant story you were talking about earlier, where he's going to retire and he's going to sing, and now they're back out and hotter than ever. But that's all happening in 1977, and something pretty significant happened to your family in 1977 as well. Your dad is going to be looking to leave the Nick Gulas promotion because, as the story goes, he has bought part of the territory.
Or he thought.
It's been told to him or explained to him later. No, you bought an option to buy into the territory, meaning, said differently, I took your money and I'm giving you nothing for it. What are you going to do about it? And your dad decided them's fighting words and did something that nobody really expected, because you even referenced earlier that Lawler couldn't just go to one of these territory shows. He had to work what was known as an outlaw show, meaning it's not somebody who's registered with the NWA and paying dues and going to meetings and all that jazz.
Or drawing money.
Yeah, they're just running little spot shows in a nothing happening two horse town
with no TV.
And Lawler goes to the NWA convention and stands up, explains what it is, and to a lot of people's surprise, gets a lot of support. So he's going to start his own thing here, but that even in itself has to be daunting to the point where even his own mother, Teeny, she ain't so sold on this. Like, son, are you sure you want to do this? Because she's been with the Gulases forever. But what Jerry, your father, knew he had is an opportunity to take the top star with him. And that's when Jerry Lawler became much more than just a top draw and a top star. He put his hands on the steering wheel and he became part owner of the promotion. And it was in large part because of your dad, right?
Mm-hmm. It's still to this day, look, business has changed, but they both had grapefruits because of the way the industry worked with handshake alliances, the promoters, the however many you divide up, 22 areas across the country or 26, whatever it may be, and just the way the business was done. But so my dad broke in late 60s. Here we are at least 10 years later. He had thought he had made payments, and he had been booking for Roy and Nick for years, and Roy was getting dementia, Alzheimer's, and Nick, put it candidly, was it real successful? Worried about booking his son, George. And my dad was, for all intents and purposes, running the show. And they were willingly, because of the success, yeah, Jerry, we're going to let you buy in. Yeah, Jerry, we're going to let you buy in. Okay, now you're buying in. Okay, you're going to have 10% of it. My dad was candidly elated. And that's because they were the owners thought that, okay, he earned this. And my dad, most importantly, thought he earned it. When he found out it was all for naught, he went, okay, it's time for me to take matters into my own hands. But if I go, I've got to have a plan. And in Memphis, it was, I think I get the call letters right, WHBQ, ABC, and in Memphis, Tennessee was when the TV was on, and he went literally down the street, across the street to the NBC affiliate, WMC-TV, and worked out a deal, and he took two people. And here's when you really think about all this, and you mentioned it, but the people that didn't go with my father, when he literally is risking a big part of his career or his entire career, Tojo Yamamoto, his in-ring partner, his mentor, blah, 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 all that. Jackie Fargo, the king of Memphis, the top babyface, another one of my dad's best friend. He was legendary. Obviously, we've talked about him. And then his own mother, who was at the time what you call the bookkeeper, but we would call him a CFO nowadays. Those three people said, hey, Jerry, we're really happy for you, and we think a lot of you, and you've been very successful. But I'm going to keep my day job. You go on, and I'm sure, and my dad said it in his own terms, hey, young kid, whippersnapper, you'll be back. Go give this a shot. But two people, at least two people that didn't say that were Lance Russell, who was the program director, and he said he would move over. Dave Brown, the weatherman, and then the third one was the top star of the territory, the King Jerry Lawler. And Lawler's a guy that knew my relationship with this organization. Yes, Nick pays me, but sometimes he tries to screw me out of payoffs. And that's kind of where the entire, I'll say, Nick started the bad payoff. Legendary stories. And I've heard it through the years. And look, we were socioeconomic territory. We didn't have a New York City or a Philadelphia or a Chicago or even an Atlanta in our markets. Memphis, Nashville, Louisville, and Evansville, the population wasn't what it was. So were our payoffs less? Sure, I'm not denying that. But Nick kind of was legendary of making shitty payoffs. That's where it started. But Lawler's relationship wasn't really with Nick, and certainly wasn't with Roy. It was with my father. My dad, for all intents and purposes, what we would call today is that was his producer. So he decided, you know what? I'm going to go with my producer. I got belief in him. My dad never forgot it, even years later, and we'll get into that. When times really got tired and the territory was going down, my dad said, Lawler, I'm going to give you part of the business. And at that time, part of the business was just the city of Memphis. It grew into Jared Enterprises, which was the whole territory. But Memphis Wrestling, which the TV was in and everything that went with it, my dad made the decision, if my top star is going, you damn right he deserves to be my partner.
Jeff, we're going to cut it right there, man. And we're going to pick up another Jerry Lawler episode in the future. And we'll talk about when he was no longer just the top star, but one of the owners. And then eventually, you know, he didn't just work in Memphis. He did have a Hall of Fame career with the WWE. All that and so much more in the future here on My World. And we would love to have your questions. If you've got a question about Jerry Lawler, go ask it right now on our YouTube. That's easy to do, by the way. It's myworldpod.com. Just go to myworldonyoutube.com. And we'll have on the community page there an opportunity for you to ask some of your Jerry Lawler questions. And when we hit the Jerry Lawler topic again, we'll hit those. In the meantime, if your business is targeting men that are 25 to 54 years old, there's no better place to advertise than right here with us at advertisewithjarrett.com. You can keep up with the shows at My World Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Jeff is pretty active across the board as well, at Real Jeff Jarrett. And you can always pick up some swag and some merch over at boxofgimmicks.com. Man, I never know what to expect when we sit down and click record, but we had a special guest run in. We talked about your action figure. We talked about you throwing tortillas in Mexico. We talked about Tony Khan getting attacked. Maybe he needs a new necklace. This was a fun episode today, man.
I love it, Connie. You know, when I was sitting there and I feel when I said, okay, I feel like Conrad, there's no way we're going to get through this. You serendipitously, do you know where you put a pin in this episode? At the, I believe, kind of at the end of Lawler's heel run.
And he's going to become the top babyface.
Yeah, I mean, we covered all of his badass heel. And because we just talked about Lawler Dundee 78, right? 78, 79. He's going to break his leg. This is kind of a cliffhanger.
That's coming.
A real life event set up. I witnessed, but I know there's others, and Kerry Von Erich had runs, but as from a territory babyface, unbelievable legendary run out of a real life event.
Is this the softball thing?
Football. Him and his.
Oh, that's right. Okay. We'll cut it right there and we'll pick it up next week, or not next week, in the future.
Yeah.
And by the way, I also want to solicit some of your suggestions.
We'll get some questions. I'd love to get questions on Lawler because he really is remarkable. And I'll just end it and I'll shut up, Conrad. I got the good opportunity. I just went down, me and Sottenham did the Memphis Grizzlies thing, appearance. Grind City Wrestling at the Grizzlies night. And me and Lawler have done that before in the past, but I got the opportunity to see Dave Brown. But Jerry, I'm getting goosebumps. I got the opportunity, so much like old times. They put me and Sottenham in one dressing room and they came in and said, hey man, Lawler's down in his dressing room if you want to drop by. And I'm like, oh, because I knew he was going to stop by. But anyway, Lawler, I got to go in there literally like old times. He was sitting in one chair and I sitting in another chair, and Dave was in there for part of this. But, you know, he just said, hey, Jeff, what's going on in your world these days? And man, we got to, it's cool. It was really, because that's, he would get to Louisville and I'd go in and ask him about finishes or time or whatever he wanted me to do. He's the boss. And he'd say, well, what's going on in your world, Jeff? You know, knowing that, hey, Lawler, I've been here since 5:30 and it's Louisville on Tuesday. Same shit we've done every week. But no, we got a chance to check up. It was good, man. It was really good. So I enjoy this episode.
I enjoy talking about Jerry Lawler. And I think one of the reasons I enjoy talking about Jerry Lawler so much with you is because without you and I even having the discussion, I got to think he's probably on your personal Mount Rushmore. Is that fair to say?
I am... blessed or graced or however you want to say it, I get the opportunity to not know. And you are business junkies.
Yeah.
Looking at Lawler through the lens of a businessman.
Yeah.
Not only my fandom and throwing a great punch and Joe Spook throwing him across. Lawler wasn't afraid of any bumps. All the wrestling stuff, and that's cool, and again, a flawed human being, the ups and the downs and the story behind the story. But the business side of it and how many tickets he sold, for me, I don't see how he's not on a Mount Rushmore. He's certainly on mine.
I can't wait for us to pay tribute to Jerry Lawler. Go ask some questions on our YouTube community page right now, and we'll be back next week right here on My World.
Peace.